Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Del Sol High School in Las Vegas, Nevada, where the president spoke today on immigration reform. Angela Maria Kelly, the Vice President of Immigration Policy and Advocacy at the Center for American Progress, joins us to outline what President Obama proposed today and assess the chances of it being implemented by Congress, where House Republicans are bitterly divided on the issue. Then we'll look into the so-called Gang of Eight senators who offered their immigration reform proposal yesterday. Since two of the four Republican senators are from Arizona, we'll look into both the president's and the senators' proposals from the perspective of the reality on the ground in Arizona, where immigration is a deeply contentious issue. Jeff Biggers, the author of State Out of the Union, Arizona and the Final Showdown Over the American Dream, joins us. Then finally, we're joined in the studio by the filmmakers of The Square, a new feature documentary on the ongoing Egyptian revolution that just won the Audience Award at Sundance. The director of The Square, Jahan Nujaim, who also directed the award-winning film The Control Room, and the producer of The Square, Karim Amer, will discuss their heroic efforts to bring the inside story of this revolution that is at the heart of the Arab Spring to the screen. And joining us now from Del Sol High School in Las Vegas, Nevada, is Angela Maria Kelly, who's the Vice President for Immigration Policy and Advocacy at the Center for American Progress, a well-known authority on the policy and politics of immigration. She has published numerous impactful reports on the economic value of immigration reform, the cost of mass deportation, and the integration trends of America's newcomers. Previously, she served as director of the Immigration Policy Center, and prior to that, was deputy director at the National Immigration Forum. Welcome to Background Briefing, Angela Maria Kelly.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, and apologies in advance for the background noise. I'm still at the high school.
Well, the president certainly gave a rousing speech, particularly given 54% of the student body are Latinos. He did, when he mentioned the Dreamers, the rafters were shaking, were they not?
Yes, the crowd went wild, as they say. There was clearly a lot of dreamers in the audience. But, you know, look, there are a lot of people who are not necessarily dreamers, but recognize that it's long overdue that we have some kind of immigration reform. And I think the president set the right tone, set the stage for that today.
Well, I thought the point that he made, which is that everybody except Native Americans here in the United States are immigrants. And then he went through the history of very briefly of the different immigrant groups that have arrived in this country. It seemed to me to be a fairly, you know, it's certainly not a controversial point, but there's so much controversy around this issue. What's your sense of what he achieved today?
Well, I think that he added his voice to what is frankly a bipartisan chorus for immigration reform. There's been a virtual stampede of Democrats and Republicans alike in both the House and Senate that are saying the time is now that we need to reform our immigration system. And he drove that point home, I think, by signaling the importance of dealing in a common sense way with the 11 million and providing them a clear roadmap to citizenship. That made a lot of sense. He talked about cracking down on employers who are not following the rules and disadvantage U.S. workers as well as immigrant workers. He talked about the importance of border security and that there's been a lot of resources put in that direction, and there needs to continue to be that. So I think that he added more texture, more depth to the conversation. And he also signaled, and I think this is particularly important, that yes, he wants Congress to act. He's got confidence in the process that started so far and was announced by eight senators yesterday, where they unveiled a blueprint, if you will, or principles for immigration reform. But that, you know, the time is now, and he won't wait forever for legislation. And so I think it's important that he also signaled that he would put the gas pedal down to the ground if the process starts to slow.
Well, when he says, though, that do we have the resolve as a people, as a country, as a government, and that even they believe that immigration reform was within our grasp, of course, back in 2007, it looked that way, too, with John McCain, George Bush, and Teddy Kennedy all joining forces, and then suddenly an avalanche of resistance appeared out of nowhere.
Well, that's true, and that was also going on 6 years ago, and a lot's changed in 6 years. You saw particularly the politics of this issue change. The Latino vote, the Asian vote, the new American vote was the biggest it's ever been, strongest it's ever been, decisive in the election. And the key issue that they point to is about immigration reform. So there's a political landscape that looks different today than it did then. And also what's changed, frankly, is the policies. We have had vigorous enforcement by both the previous administration and the Bush and the Obama administration. You know, President Obama deported more people in year three of his administration than Bush did in 8 years. There's much more cooperation between local police and immigration agents. There's a more secure border than there's ever been. I could go on and on. And while we've got certainly concerns with some of those enforcement policies, the overall picture is undeniable that we have put a lot of resources in enforcement, and we still have a high degree of we still have a big number of folks who are living here without papers. So you can't enforce your way out of the problem. And I think that policy realization is also different than 2007. So the two flows of a political landscape that's different and policies where you can check a lot of boxes that we've done everything we can do would suggest that now is the time for reform and that it's ripened in a way that it hadn't in 2007.
And in terms of both the Senate proposal from the Gang of Eight and what the president said today at the high school in Las Vegas, where you are, Angela Maria Kelly, of course, the two things that stick out in terms of the cart, the horse before the cart, the horse being securing the border and then the cart being a pathway to immigration for the 11 million people here. There's no sense of exactly when and how you certify that the border is secure. And until that is done, I imagine the people who are in the shadows won't want to come out and expose themselves unless there is a secure path offered there.
Yep. You're pointing to what's going to be an important feature of any legislation, and that is the interplay between the requirements in terms of border security and how the 11 million are treated. And we have to ensure that we still have a vigorous enforcement at the border and that it that it keeps pace with changing technology. And so that's absolutely critically important. But to the extent that you're going to hold back on treating the 11 million and dealing with them sensibly, we have to be sure that those triggers are achievable, that they're measurable, and that's important detail that's not been provided. And then also the question you were asking is, what's going to happen with the 11 million in the meantime? So these are important details that we'll look at with a microscope, but we don't know yet what that's going to look like.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Angela Maria Kelly.
All right. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Angela Maria Kelly, who is the Vice President for Immigration Policy and Advocacy at the Center for American Progress. She's a well-known authority on the policy and the politics of immigration, and she's published numerous impactful reports on the economic value of immigration reform, the cost of mass deportation, and the integration trends of America's newcomers. Previously, she served as director of the Immigration Policy Center, and prior to that was deputy director of the National Immigration Forum. She was in the audience today at Del Sol High School in Las Vegas, where President Obama outlined his proposals for immigration reform. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back talking further about immigration reform.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold. And it's just across the border line. Time to send someone away. Got my back covered. Said, how you been all that astray? Come, let's count. They lead you to the race, but no one's asked them to.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeff Biggers, the American Book Award-winning author of several books of history and memoir, including The United States of Appalachia in the Sierra Madre and Reckoning at Eagle Creek, which received the Sierra Club's David Brower Award for Environmental Reporting. Raised in Tucson, Arizona, his latest book is State Out of the Union, Arizona and the Final Showdown Over the American Dream. He writes regularly for Salon and the Huffington Post and performs monologues based on his work at theaters and festivals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Biggers.
Thanks for having me on.
And apropos your book about Arizona, in this so-called Gang of Eight, which are four Republicans and four Democratic senators who put forward a immigration reform plan, two of the four Republicans, Jeff Flake and John McCain, are from Arizona. So it would seem a bit of a contradiction here. Arizona has displayed a tremendous hostility towards immigrants, particularly from the South. And yet the two senators from Arizona appear to be at least a little more enlightened on the issue than their fellow Arizonans.
Right, and I think the even greater irony, too, is both Flake, but especially John McCain, made quite a turn to the right during the election campaigns, McCain in particular, in 2010, calling for an extreme buildup on the border and sort of placated the anti-immigrant vote there just to get elected. John McCain, of course, has had a very good history of being a moderate on immigration issues. And as you recall, Ian, back not quite 10 years ago, he worked with Ted Kennedy in the Senate to have an immigration bill and eventually had to throw in the towel. So McCain's return in some respects is to be expected. But I think we really have to understand they're motivated less by any sense of immigration reform and more by the political reality that they have lost the Latino vote.
Well, John McCain actually said that at the press conference when the Gang of Eight, the eight senators, announced their proposal. He was quite blunt about it, that Republicans are losing the Latino vote.
Right. And therefore, I think you have to really look at this immigration proposal and what it's calling for and try to sort some sort of fact from fiction and have a little bit of reality check. I think the first thing to really to look at is the issue of border security, that they're calling basically for a slower pathway to citizenship, definitely slower than the president wants, in order to secure the border, which is really a code word for the far right and for the anti-immigrants for a greater buildup on the border. And I think, once again, we have to be really careful and have a reality check of their approach on this kind of immigration reform.
Well, none of the senators made it clear exactly when the border would be considered secure. So if that's the first step before the pathway to citizenship, that seems to be what they're saying, that we won't, until we secure the border, you can't become citizens, speaking of the 11 million undocumented immigrants here in the United States.
Right. You know, on one hand, if we take them for their word, if we really interpret that literally, that's great because, you know, according to the Pew Hispanic Center last year, we had a net zero migration from Mexico. That, in fact, as we know, we've had the lowest apprehensions of undocumented people since the 1970s. That, in fact, crime in the borderlands has gone down for the first time in decades. And so I think, once again, if we want to take them for the word, well, yeah, the border is secure now so we can move forward. But I think, obviously, they're approaching this from the perspective, and a lot of this is misperception of what's truly happening on the borderlands, that we somehow still have a border problem. And let's not forget, Ian, too, that we spend nearly $18 billion every year on immigration enforcement, which is more than the combined federal funds for all criminal law enforcement. That includes the FBI, the Secret Service, and so many other programs. You know, $18 billion already on immigration enforcement, and now we're trying to add to that tally, and clearly what's going to be a buildup of both the Border Patrol and military hardware and drones there on the border.
So, again, Jeff Biggers is the author of State Out of the Union, Arizona and the Final Showdown Over the American Dream. And we're talking about the Senate's proposal of the Gang of Eight senators, John McCain, Chuck Schumer, Lindsey Graham, Dick Durbin, Marco Rubio, Bob Menendez, Jeff Flake, and Michael Bennett, who have joined forces to offer an immigration reform ahead, of course, the president's announcement today. And when you say, Jeff Biggers, that the border really isn't an issue, is that to say that it is secure now?
I believe everybody, you know, and the facts do show that the border is secure now, or at least migration, undocumented migration, has slowed to a trickle. You know, and I think a lot of that, of course, is related more, as we've shown historically, to our economy more than a lot of these measures like Operation Gatekeeper that have been enforced. I think another issue, too, which we really have to discuss, Ian, is this issue of deportation. Here we are dealing with the Obama administration, which has had record high levels of deportation. Nearly 1.5 million immigrants have been deported under the Obama administration. And so what I'm hearing from immigrant rights advocates and border advocates is that there needs to be a moratorium on deportations and really a discussion about separations of families as the first step in any kind of immigration reform. Because I think, as we all know, now we're going to wade into this kind of legal limbo, these several months of debate and discussion and whatnot with the Congress. And in the meantime, every day you're having hundreds, if not thousands, of people who are deported.
So when does the deportation stop and the 11 million people are allowed to come out of the shadows and start the paperwork to become legal? I mean, over 50% apparently have overstayed their visas. That seems to be the most common form of illegal immigration here in the United States. So, you know, obviously, if you're one of the 11 million, you don't want to come out of the shadows until you know you're safe. And if they're still deporting people, you're not going to come out of the shadows. So I'm kind of confused.
Right. I think that's where a lot of people are really beginning to ask a lot of questions. Obviously, yesterday's proposal, combined with what the president said today, is extremely vague. And I think they essentially floated this new proposal and they'll hammer out the final details this spring. But I think right now the vagueness of the language is really, which put a lot of concern to a lot of immigrant rights people. At the same time, I think people certainly are welcoming the language that there would be some sort of pathway to citizenship, that there would be some element of a work program for farm workers. There would be some type of employment verification system. But I think in terms of the actual details, there's still much to be seen, to see how authentic it really is going to be.
So, Jeff Biggers, when John McCain admits that they're really motivated by the fact that in this last election, the Republican Party did not attract very many Latino votes, to say the least, and way down from the 40% they got under George W. Bush. And most of what they've discussed have been sort of public relations maneuvers rather than any substantive change of heart on the part of a lot of the Tea Party constituency of the Republican Party, who are in effect, I think, motivated by racism as much as and xenophobia as much as anything else. In the state of Arizona, where you were born and raised and about which you wrote recently in your book, Stayed Out of the Union, Arizona and the Final Showdown Over the American Dream, that state was about the last, I think, to be counted in the election in terms of the votes because of hostility to Latino voters and voter suppression on the part of people like Sheriff Joe Arpaio. So there's got to be a lot of bitterness there in the Latino community, surely.
Bitterness is just the beginning of it. I think there's a historic distrust. I think there's definitely been what I talked about is really an ongoing cultural showdown, really over the past century. I mean, we're even going back all the way back to the 19th century when we've had these discussions over citizenship and who has the right to immigrate and who doesn't, and who has the right to call themselves an American. So I think you're perfectly true. It's that what we're dealing with is an issue, and this is sort of a final showdown, this immigration bill, of something that Arizonans have particularly been dealing with for over a century because they are there in the borderlands, just like Texas and in many respects like New Mexico and California. I think the Republican Party is trying to scramble, as we all know, because of what happened in the elections. And I think there's a huge difference between giving lip service, for example, now to the deferred action for Dreamers and giving lip service to some sort of employment program for farm workers and giving lip service to some sort of citizenship pathway than truly being engaged and involved with the immigrant communities and the Latino communities in every state. So I think the Republicans certainly have a lot to learn from this situation beyond just sort of lip service to it. And I think the debate we're going to have this spring, Ian, is really going to be fascinating because I think it's going to sort of separate the wolves from the sheep, so to speak, in this immigration debate and really see where the Republican Party is. Because as we know, the Republican Party last fall, under Romney's presidential campaign, but also just under the party in general, completely embraced Arizona's largely anti-immigrant approach. And I think it's still said to be seen if they've learned from that experience to really reach back into the communities and having some really serious discussions.
But there seems to be, just politically in Arizona, a very reactionary element, including the author of that SB 1070 anti-immigrant bill, and along with Arpaio, the sheriff there. And I just recall we were talking about earlier, John McCain's 2010 campaign, where he's walking along the border with that sheriff with the shaved head. The pandering is disgraceful. So obviously he feels that he has to pander to those people. What are the numbers there, given the demographic reality of the emerging Latino majority or the non-white majority in this country? Is this the last gasp of white power?
Well, I think it definitely is the last gasp of sort of a racist, extremist approach. I mean, we have about 35% of the vote in Arizona came from the Latino community. I think what we know is there's a greater historic demographic shift taking place that really is going to unfold in the next 2 to 4 to 6 years. When you have 80% of the aged population is Anglo or white, and if you have 60 to 65% of the young population, those under 18, are Latino or brown, I think obviously you don't have to be a math expert to realize there's a major demographic shift that's going to be happening. The same thing that's happened in California, it's happening really across the country. And I think you're really hitting it, that this extremism that we've seen in Arizona for the past few years is a rehashing of an extremism we see almost every 20 years whenever there is some sort of political shift or a rise of a particular power on behalf of the Latinos. There's this small cadre of the Republicans who sort of have an anti-immigrant spasm and try to use that for political gain. This time around, Ian, I think we are at a hinge moment. And I think that's why you see people like McCain, who obviously is at the end of his career, and people like Jeff Flake, who now has just started as a senator, he's been a longtime member of Congress, who now are going to try to gravitate back to the center, because I think they've seen largely that this kind of extremism has been rejected in the state. At the same time, you're perfectly correct. There are people like Sheriff Joe Arpaio and Sheriff Paul Babu, who just went on to Reverend Al Sharpton's show a couple of days ago, calling President Obama a dictator because of his gun policy. And so we have still these kind of extremist elements, these larger-than-life TV characters is really what they are, who have an incredibly important role on the local level as county sheriffs. And I think until that ilk is eventually pushed out of the Republican Party, we still have a long way to go in Arizona.
Well, it would seem, though, that the Tea Party talk radio wing of the Republican Party are the problem that all Republican moderates have. And it was interesting that Marco Rubio, who's obviously angling to become the Republican nominee for president in 2016, he went on Rush Limbaugh's program to try and beat down that kind of racism, which Limbaugh, of course, has expressed any number of times. So what's your sense? I mean, just looking at these senators, this gang of eight, Schumer, I guess there's probably a Latino population in New York, Graham in South Carolina, I'm not sure about that, Dick Durbin in Illinois, there's a substantial Latino population, Rubio, of course, being a Cuban-American in Florida, Menendez, New Jersey, there's also a big Cuban population there, and Jeff Flake, Arizona, of course, we know about the enormous Latino population there, and Michael Bennett in Colorado. So, to be cynical, in many ways, to me,
what's going on here is the Democrats want the votes, which they've gotten so far because the Republicans have been stupid and racist and insulting. But on the other hand, the Republicans see it more as a public relations problem, and what they really want is cheap labor.
Right, right. And I think that's very important. And I think that's where a lot of these little details in this proposal, in fact, become very important, and not just little details like the employment verification system under E-Verify. That's largely been proven to be flawed and harmful to the labor market, and that's something they're trying to push through. Once again, this kind of probationary legal status. I think those little details, I think, are very important. I think you're right. On the other hand, Ian, I think what's important about what's happening in the past 2 days with this immigration reform is that we are at least changing the narrative in the country about the role of immigrants, that there's no longer this denial of the contribution of immigrants, but recognizing that they are, in fact, part of the fabric of who we are and who they have always been, that we are a nation of immigrants. And I think just getting over that hump, as obvious it may seem to you and I and to a lot of listeners, is a nice shift just in the discussion. I've been engaged in this discussion over immigrants for so long, and it's amazing still to go into public forums to people who still deny the worth of anybody who has immigrated recently. They don't recognize the role of immigrants from every step of our lives, be it in the service industry, in the construction industry, in the high-tech industry, in the energy industry, to our daily food, to every part. And so at least changing that narrative to recognize the contributions of immigrants, I think, is extremely important and extremely valuable. I think part of that narrative, though, of the misperception of border security, the misperception of immigrants as criminals, the probationary status in that area, that's still part of the narrative that we need to struggle with and shift, especially amongst Republicans. So in many respects, I feel like what's happening is very positive, but at the same time, I'm with you that we have to be very careful that it doesn't sort of get sideswiped into just a political, very cynical political move by either party. And we both know that both parties have basically used immigrants as a political football, both pro and con, for years. And I think now, finally, we have an immigrant rights community, a very strong Latino community, who are saying we no longer want to be a political football, and we need some really substantive reform bills. And so that's what I'm hoping will happen this spring.
Well, Jeff Bickers, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeff Bickers, the American Book Award-winning author of several books of history and memoir, including The United States of Appalachia in the Sierra Madre and Reckoning at Eagle Creek. He is raised in Tucson, Arizona, and his latest book is State Out of the Union, Arizona and the Final Showdown Over the American Dream. He writes regularly for Salon and Huffington Post and performs monologues based on his work at theaters and festivals. We're going to take a brief station break and be joined in the studio by the filmmakers of a documentary about Tahrir Square, The Square.
Them say the revolution won't be televised. Al Jazeera proved them wrong. Twitter has them paralyzed. 80 million strong, it ain't no longer gonna be terrorized. Organized, mobilized, vocalized. On the side of truth, the Madunya's living proof that it's a matter of time for the chickens home to roost. Bu Azizi lit the hoof. And it slowly ignited the fire within Arab people to fight it. From Tunis to Khan Yunis, the new moon shines bright as the man's.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is the director of the new film that just won the Sundance Audience Award, The Square. The director is here in the studio with me, Jahan Najim, and also the producer, Karim Amir. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
Thank you.
And your film couldn't be better timed, in as much as let me just sketch some of the headlines today coming out of Egypt. The president, Morsi, is in Germany. He has to cut short his trip because of unrest at home. The head of the military in Egypt has warned today that the country is on the verge of collapse, and unless the political factions find a way to agree without taking to the streets, the country will collapse. And, of course, Morsi's in traveling around trying to get an IMF loan, which he desperately needs. Country's clearly paralyzed. And, of course, your film, The Square, starts with the revolution, which we just had the second anniversary of a couple of days ago. But it's really about how the revolution continues. And, boy, is it continuing.
It is. I think that we knew pretty quickly after Mubarak had stepped down. We met all of our characters before he stepped down, but we realized quite quickly that it was just the beginning of the fight when he stepped down. There was still the security apparatus in place, the police state. There was still, the corrupt media, and all of this needed to be, that our characters felt needed to be changed.
And it would seem that, just in a broad sense, the people who led that revolution, who propelled the revolution, who made the basic sacrifices for that revolution, essentially got, what's the right word? They didn't get conned so much as it sort of got stolen out from under them. That's the feeling that one has from looking at it from abroad, that somehow the military and the Muslim Brotherhood made some backroom deals that have guided the post-revolutionary politics to the point where the people who brought about the revolution have been sidelined and the people who benefit from the revolution are now in power.
I think if you see the film, that's what you'll see. You'll see the very personal, intimate story behind those headlines. You'll see the Muslim Brotherhood character who we start following from the very first days, very, very loyal Muslim Brotherhood character, Magdi, who has been part of the Muslim Brotherhood for 25 years and then starts to realize that there's a lot of political opportunism happening on the part of the Muslim Brotherhood and starts to turn against them in the middle. You have to see what happens. You have to watch the movie to see what happens. But I think that many of our characters felt like there was a massive fight to bring down Mubarak and an even bigger fight to bring down the military dictatorship. And they dealt a major blow to the military. And their third battle is against the Muslim Brotherhood coming to power and instilling another dictatorship.
And the producer of the film, Karim Amir, what is the motive, though, of the military in making this sort of devil's bargain with the Muslim Brotherhood? And you could see from the results of the presidential election, based on the French system of a runoff, that the socialist candidate and the more liberal or less conservative, I should say, Muslim Brotherhood candidate together, they had so many more votes. But it felt to me at the time that this was a way to divide the opposition to ensure what the military seemed to want is the worst possible outcome in terms of Morsi, who is far more conservative than the other candidate representing the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, I think it's a very good question. I mean, I think... interestingly enough, we continued filming from the 18 days, the original beginning of Jan 25th, 2011, all the way through the presidential elections and during and up until recently. We're still filming till today. But during that period, we actually we got unbelievable access to film inside three different presidential campaigns inside their main campaign offices. So we had a real interesting perspective onto what was going on between the different camps and what was being said and who was accusing who of what. And I think if we're going to split this question into two parts, the first part being why was the military cooperating with the Muslim Brotherhood, this kind of devil's deal, I think it's twofold. One is that the military is a very runs like a normal military. It's organized. It's driven from the top down, and it's not the most democratic institution. They find that the Muslim Brotherhood is very similar. So when the head of the military sits with the head of the Muslim Brotherhood, decision making can be made quite easily. They agree on something. The next day, all of the people in the Muslim Brotherhood follow. Same with the military. So there is a kind of even though they have a tradition of actually having a lot of conflict with each other, if you look historically, the relationship between Muslim Brotherhood and the military has been one of tension throughout the last 50 years in Egypt. they know how to do business with each other, so to speak. So that's one thing. The other thing is, yes, there was definitely, we witnessed that there was a push to support the Muslim Brotherhood, and that the system by which the elections were taking part was set to fail. And that is why our characters, if you watch the film, feel very disillusioned with the whole democratic process. You know, so they're criticized for not voting, for example. But in their eyes, they're like, how can I vote when A, blood is spilling on the street as we speak, and B, I know that the system is rigged. I know that I'm in a rigged system. Democracy is not just about holding an election. And that's a big issue that we've had with American audiences and American public in terms of conversation, like from people that have visited from the United States to Tahrir Square and come to our offices to just us coming here and speaking with different people. They're like, well, why don't you guys focus more on the vote? And we're like, it's not just about the vote. You know, I mean, if you look in America, oftentimes we like to measure the success and failures of democracy based off the election process. But if we look at what makes democracies work, it's much more complicated than just one election. And now in terms of, you know, the only thing that I was able to conclude of my experience with the presidential election was the following, is that although these two groups may hate each other, the Muslim Brotherhood and the army, these are the two people who've been, they're two guys fighting in a room, and they might hate each other, but they don't want a new person to join that fight. So as much as they don't like each other, their interest to keep anyone else out is really what drove the election process and continues to drive the choice. I mean, what we say in Egypt is that Egypt for 5,000 years has been ruled by the pharaoh, you know, and we've always had either two choices, either a religious pharaoh or a military pharaoh. For the first time on January 25th, 2011, Egyptians chose for themselves and said, we will no longer live under the pharaoh, we will be the people and the people will rule. And I think that both power structures, the Muslim Brotherhood and the army, are extremely threatened by that.
Again, I'm joined in the studio by Jahan Nujaim, who is an Egyptian-American documentary film director, best known for her films Control Room, Pangea Day, and Startup.com, which won the 2001 Grand Jury Prize. And her latest film, The Square, was just awarded the Sundance Audience Award for World Cinema Documentary. And also in the studio is producer of The Square, Karim Amer. Just go back to 2 years ago with the original revolution. You were arrested. You were singled out, even though you were talking to a high-ranking military officer, and then I guess some what intelligence guy or one of those thugs in suits came out of nowhere and said you were an American spy, right?
It was
and you got disappeared.
it was during the height of the battle on the street, Mohammed Mahmoud, which is about three quarters of the way through the movie, and we were actually filming the ceasefire, and then all hell broke loose when there was a tear gas canister that was randomly fired and rocks started, and I was with Karim actually and his sister Dina Amer, who writes for the New York Times, and they ran. We all got dispersed by tear gas. We ran in different directions. They ran back. I ran forward with another one of our characters, Megdi, the Muslim Brotherhood character. Part of the reason why I was going forward was because I had been trying to get the perspective of the army. So I wanted to. We'd been filming on the from the perspective of the
protesters.
And so I was interviewing this guy in this gigantic gas mask. I just asked for an interview and he said, no problem, you know, are you sure you can hear me through this thing? And everything seemed to be cool. And then we were there for about 15 minutes and then I was like, I think it's time to get out of here. But on the way out, we were stopped by a guy wearing a completely black mask, which is scary because when people are wearing black masks, they don't want to be known. They don't want their identity to be known. But he stopped and said, Jahan. And I was sort of shocked. And he must have known that I had been filming in the square for the year and a half before. And he handed me over to the police. And then the trick is, this is to try to get people, you know, off to stop filming, to stop journalists from being there, to stop people going down to the streets. if you can just, you know, stick them in a police car and drive them around and disappear them for 8 hours, that's like, that's a deterrent, you know, from coming back again. It doesn't work that way because people get so outraged by this happening that they go back down to the streets. And that's exactly how I felt. I felt like this movie has to come out, you know, more strongly. But one of our characters luckily found me, Rajia Amran, who's an incredible human rights lawyer. You know, you have to understand that the country's, you know, being on the protester side, you really see individuals coming through and taking the law into their own hands. You know, Rajia Amran, who's a human rights lawyer, uses law, and she's not being paid, but she spent the last 2 years getting people out of jail that shouldn't be in jail. So people who can use a camera, use a camera. People who use the voice can use their voice. People are using whatever they can, you know, to try to change things. So anyway.
But you have to tell them how you got found.
Oh, she posted. So Rajia posts my picture on Twitter and puts it out to her vast community of Twitter followers. And this time I'd been gone for, I don't know, 10 hours or something.
Yeah, about like 8-10 hours. We couldn't find Jahan anywhere. And then, you know, how one of the most amazing things, and we've seen this in the film and in the events of the revolution, is in terms of people using technology as well to kind of create this network of information. And so Rajia sends a picture of Jahan, and then randomly Jahan happened to be, she finally got permission from one of the officers to use the bathroom.
Well, to try to find a bathroom. They basically said good luck, you know, but 10 hours later I was going to find some corner or someplace.
By coincidence, one of the human rights lawyers happened to be walking down that hallway at the same time and spotted her from the picture. And then he wrote back quickly, like, I think I just saw her, she's in this building. And then so all of a sudden, so what happens in these type of situations, and all of a sudden a group of people will come to that building and be like, okay, we know she's inside, we're not leaving till we get access to her. And then it begins. But that's the first step. At least you've located the person. And now it's about applying the pressure to see, you know, how you'll be able to get that person out. But of course, all this happens because Jahan is the kind of filmmaker who pushes and pushes. And that's the only way you can when you're trying to capture these kinds of stories. I mean, she definitely, to say she's on the front lines is a bit of an understatement. She goes to the other side of the front line.
I think all of us did. I mean, this was a true collaboration, this film. We all met in the square. You know, you can't decide you're going to make this movie and then hire a bunch of people to join you, right? It was all people who felt like they had to be there, felt like they had to be documenting it. And then we got together and decided to make this film together.
And of course, the square is both literally and figuratively the heart of freedom, is it? That's the beating heart of freedom. It's where people just go. It's really, I guess, the continuing metaphor for revolution.
That's a very, very good way of putting it. And one of our characters said one time that it was sometimes going there was like breathing oxygen, because you felt like what had been created in the square was as close as they had ever experienced to what they wanted their country to look like. And the desire was to try to create Tahrir Square in the rest of Egypt.
So let's talk about that then, Jahan, and also Karim, because it feels like, given that the people who brought about the revolution had it stolen from under them by this kind of complicity between the Muslim Brotherhood and the military, and the military are now warning that the country is about to collapse, it's pretty clear that all calls for calm and aren't being listened to, that in effect, the people who really have lost out, whether or not we can argue about the tactics of whether to vote or not, whether that was wise or not. But what it seems to come down to now is that the continuing revolutionaries have really got nowhere to go unless their demands are met. And they keep sort of offering little compromises, but they're not obviously going to give up power. So that's just my brief analysis of it. Give us yours.
The revolution was never about the entire country changing in order for real change to happen. The revolution has always been about a dedicated few number of people that are not willing to compromise. And what they're not willing to compromise on is their basic demands for freedom, for civil rights, for the ability to live in a country where their dignity can be restored and where they can be proud to be Egyptian. That's what the revolution's about. And what we've witnessed is that you do not need an entire country to change a country. And if we look at historically throughout social movements around the world, you'll find that very rarely were there social movements that were led by the majority of the country. They were led by small groups that stuck with it, and they stuck with it, and they kept fighting, and they kept fighting. And oftentimes, the expense of that journey became that those groups became a little bit more disillusioned with some of the realities of the rest of the public, because they were living in such a emotionally intense environment. In Egypt, I think that this movement is about the youth. I think that the youth are the representation of what Egypt's future is demanding. I think that the...
By the way, the youth, what's the division between secular and religious amongst the youth?
The division between secular and religious among the youth is, you know, yeah, obviously the Muslim Brotherhood has a youth component as well, then there's the secular youth. But what I think the main fight is, and I think that this is oftentimes not as... It doesn't transcend as clearly to outside audiences, is that it's not about religious versus non-religious. That's not really the big divide in Egypt. It's about people claiming their rights and continuing to claim their rights against a dictatorship, against a totalitarian system, against any power structure that refuses to acknowledge that Egypt has fundamentally shifted. What the revolution's demand was in the beginning was al-shab yurid iskat al-nizam. The people demand the move of the regime. And what the regime means is the entire power structure. So it's not just about getting rid of Mubarak. It's not just about getting rid of the military. It's not just about getting rid of the Muslim Brotherhood. Because all of these people, what they're witnessing is that even though the leaderless revolution, as we like to call it, hasn't been able to create a political momentum that is able to manifest itself into a political victory that can rule the country, it is able to create a wave of opposition. And how that wave works is that when any group sits on that power structure seat, whether it be Mubarak or the military or the Muslim Brotherhood, when they fail to acknowledge that Egypt's fundamentally changed, that the hopes and aspirations of these youth will continue to fight forward, they will fail. And that's what's happening. The government has failed once again. And actually, we're doing better, because it took us 30 years to get Mubarak out. It took us a year and a half to acknowledge that the military was creating injustice. And it's within less than 6 months that President Morsi, the first freely elected president in Egyptian history, is facing the same opposition. So democracy is a process. The Egyptian revolution will continue. And I think that the youth who we feel have been left out are actually starting to gain a lot more credibility, because people are finding that, you know what, you guys were right along from the whole beginning. And one of the characters in our film says that in the beginning, she says, you know, one of the people, because it's a generational issue, someone from an older generation tells her, what do you guys want? You've already got Mubarak out. What else do you want? And she's like, if you remove somebody and you get people just like them, then you haven't done anything. And so that's what we're witnessing.
Again, I'm joined in the studio by Jahan Nujaim, who is Egyptian-American documentary film director, best known for her film Control Room. She's also directed The Square, which was just awarded the Sundance Audience Award for World Cinema Documentary, and the producer also of this film, The Square. Producer Karim Amer is joining me here in the studio, and we're talking about the film, which has not yet to be released, although clearly it's gaining a lot of interest, having won the audience award.
We just finished it 2 days before. I mean, we didn't even have time to put credits on the film.
It sounds like the sequel's already being made.
Right. No. So we basically have not finished. We're still filming, and I just wanted to say that in order to keep this, because this can be useful for other filmmakers to hear, in order to keep this completely independent, we were not funded in making the film. We took loans from family. And people worked for deferred. So as we were talking about earlier, we're just funding it now. And
right.
We're doing a Kickstarter campaign. So
good.
The Square Kickstarter.
How do potential investors get in touch with you?
They go to thesquare@kickstarter.com and also to our Facebook page, which is The Square on Facebook. So we would love support. Even a dollar counts.
So let's just talk about the broader issues that you just brought up, Karim, in this much as not only is what you've described really, I think, a very, very interesting and useful analysis of what's happening in Egypt, but there is this broader context of the Arab Spring. And it seems to me that so many people are talking about the Arab winter now and suggesting that it's all fizzled, but it obviously hasn't. And that's what's so interesting. And I think that's also, isn't that a huge component that not only are you and your comrades responsible for keeping the revolution alive in Egypt, but you're also responsible for keeping the whole idea of the Arab Spring alive in the Middle East and the broader Islamic world. And the entire globe, frankly. It's not just about Islam.
Well, I think it's a fairy tale to have said that, you know, we could possibly have changed a country in like Egypt in 2 weeks. And so, you know, when Mubarak stepped down, that was really just the beginning. And I think that people realize that this fight is going to go on for a long time. And one of our characters said it's going to be 10 years before I even know, you know, what we've actually accomplished. But this isn't even about, I don't believe that this film is about Egypt or even about the Arab world. This is a film about a people's revolution and a people's fight. We know from the civil rights in the U.S. that rights are not given to you, they're taken. And you have to keep taking them and you have to keep fighting for them. And the minute that you stop fighting and taking, things start to slip away. And so that's what you're seeing in the film, is you're seeing these characters decide that they are not living in a country where they don't want to have kids in a country where they can't have dignity, where their human rights are not respected. And when only two police officers, for example, have been tried or put in prison for the hundreds and hundreds of deaths that happened during the revolution, you know that those rights are not being realized.
And of course you had the tremendous riots and backlash to the verdicts for the soccer riots where the police, for which the police were responsible and for which they have not been held accountable. So, you know, it's the impression I get is it's not just young Egyptians that are outraged by the situation, but it covers all across, you know, working class, middle class, the whole spectrum of society. Is that am I correct in that, Karim?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, this is, it's the young characters, some of whom we follow, maybe the spearheading this movement, but they're reflecting a feeling that's boiling throughout the whole country. And it's and to us, we really believe that this is a feeling that's boiling throughout the entire Middle East and the whole world. I mean, what's happening in Tahrir Square, when you said it was the bastion of freedom, it really is something that, you know, if you follow it, there's the echo chambers of it happening in Athens, happening in Moscow, happening in New York City, where young people and different people, the movements might not be for the same reasons, they might not look the same, they might not speak the same languages, but it's the same thing that's happening. That's what our film tries to show. It's young people that are deciding to say, that's it, we've had enough, we're taking things into our own hands, and we refuse to live in systems where the power structure is not representative of the people. That the violations of that social contract and the context of that violation are different from country to country, but it's the same fundamental crying out. And what we're witnessing within this new age, and our film shows this, with people using online technology and Twitter and Facebook and using the camera as their weapon, is that we're living in an age where accountability will hopefully be more fast-paced and where young people will be able to hold their governments more accountable. And that's what we're hoping that the film can get across.
And Jahan, it seems to me that what's likely here is that at some point or other, there'll be a declaration of martial law. Obviously, it's uncomfortable for Morsi to go that way because he's supposedly the revolutionary. But that's just my hunch that's where we're heading. What's your feeling?
Well, there was martial law declared yesterday, right, in Port Said.
In three cities.
In three cities. Mm-hmm. So you're right on in your hunch.
Mm-hmm. But people ignored it. But see that's the fundamental. That's right. You know, Morsi's gone back to the same tactics of Mubarak, just like the military did. And what they're failing to acknowledge is that Egypt fundamentally changed. People, once he tried to put the martial law, people ignored it. People will no longer, the fear barrier has been broken. That's it. You cannot take that back from people. You cannot put people back in the closet, lock them and tell them, you know what, your voice won't be heard. That's it. People are refusing to live in those conditions. And he's suffering the consequences of it. And if he does not take immediate action, of which economic is one of the fundamental basis of the country, will fall apart, as the military is saying, because he's driving people to the point of explosion. I mean, that's really what's happening. And the coming revolution won't just be led by young revolutionary youth who are hoping for, you know, freedom of expression. It'll be led by a much more violent, aggressive revolution of all kinds of people from the streets taking things into their own hands in a much more aggressive way. And
well, just in closing, let me ask Jahan Nujaim, the obviously youth unemployment is endemic, both on the north and south side of the Mediterranean, from Morocco to Egypt, from Greece to Spain, between 55-60% and 30% in all of the countries in that region, it seems. So is there a way that and then Morsi's out there trying to get this IMF loan, is there a way that they can kind of buy off these, what we're talking about here, with employment? Or is it, I mean, it's so corrupt, isn't it, that the crony capitalism that was set up over those decades and decades of misrule under the dictatorship, military dictatorships, it's so entrenched. I mean, it requires more than just a jobs program, right?
And it's going to take, well, it's going to take a long time. I mean, things have been broken apart, cracked apart, you know, and now, it's going to take an economic program. The economic program of Morsi is very similar to the economic program of Mubarak. And it's going to need a different economic program. And in terms of something like an IMF loan, that's definitely not going to be able to, you know, by change what we're talking about, right? I mean, people are demanding, it's more than jobs. It's about demanding human dignity. It's about demanding basic human rights. Yes, there's huge economic problems, and those economic problems need to be solved. But the legal system needs to be put in place, a proper legal system. People need to be held accountable, and that hasn't happened yet.
Economic freedom is what people are asking for. I mean, that's one of the things that people don't acknowledge as well. And in the West, sometimes they look at Egypt's revolution. It wasn't just about political freedom. It was about economic freedoms as well. And we said the original chant was bread, freedom, and social equality. So, and when we say freedom in Egypt, the average Egyptian views freedom as freedom to live in a decent home, freedom to be able to provide for your children, freedom as an ability to pay for your health care and your health bills. That's the kind of freedoms that people asked for. And what's making people so outraged is that the Muslim Brotherhood is failing to reach those hopes that the Egyptian people want.
Or to put it together a plan. I mean, to put together a plan that has some legs.
And the solutions of those are not just going to be based off any kind of loan. The solutions are based off inspiring the country to work together again, on building a coalition government that's representative, on creating programs for young people to be able to work and build and have homes and feel part that they are participants in the economy.
Well, we could talk on, and I'm afraid we've run out of time. And I thank you both for joining us here in the studio. Jahan Nujaim, the Egyptian-American documentary film director, best known for her film Control Room. Her latest film, The Square, was just awarded the Sundance Audience Award for World Cinema Documentary. And the producer of the film, Karim Amir, producer of The Square, is also here with us. And I thank you both for joining us.
Thank you. Hopefully it'll be coming to a square near you.
Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'm